Tom Woods Show, episode 1964.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, don't even think about missing the libertarian event of the year, the 2000th episode of the Tom Woods Show, live in Orlando, featuring many of your favorites from the Tom Woods Show, and Michael Malice says his special surprise guest, whose identity I myself don't even know, will bring the house down. Cost nothing to attend. Register at tomwoods2000.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Today our guest is Stephen Presser, who is Raoul Berger Professor of Legal History Emeritus at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law, and he is the author of a recent article commemorating the 20th anniversary of the Patriot Act and major aspects of the surveillance state as they have developed over the past 20 years. And I thought that's as good a time as any to talk about him and to look back on all this. But no doubt we will have plenty of other things to say on related topics. Professor Presser, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's a treat to be with you, Tom.
I was just saying that the last time you were here was for an episode that aired February 15th, 2019. How naive we were in those days, not having lived through the end of the world from last year. And I'll tell you, as bad as I thought things were in 2019, I would take February 2019 in a second if it were offered to me now.
That makes two of us, I'm afraid.
Oh, just crazy. Well, I was reading, of course, my favorite print magazine, which is Chronicles, because I got an advanced copy of the, I guess it must be the September issue for September 11th. Correct. And you have an article in there called The Surveillance State Turns 20. And I thought that is just such a natural for the Tom Woods Show. So we're talking about, but not confining ourselves exclusively to, the Patriot Act. And I remember maybe several years after the Patriot Act, I don't remember exactly how many, but National Review wrote an article and they were responding to something Judge Andrew Napolitano had written, warning about the problems with the Patriot Act and it can do this and it can do that and they can ask for your history of what books you've taken out of the library and so on and so forth. And the National Review just mocked him and said, it's hardly been used at all. It's just a handful of times with a handful of obviously guilty people. You know, you civil libertarians are always, you're emotional hypochondriacs. There's nothing to worry about here. And I think when looking at the Patriot Act, especially in the wake of 9/11, as you say in your article, even civil libertarians, by and large, had barely really combed through it. What do we say to people who say, I don't do anything wrong. I couldn't remotely be suspected of terrorism. I'm not sending international correspondence. Why should this worry me?
Well, it should worry you, if for nothing else, for the fact that you remember when Donald Trump was a candidate, he fell into the net of national security. And the problem with the act, and indeed is not only the act, but the FISA court and probably countless other federal regulations that give our intelligence services now very, very free rein. And it's the real problem is not necessarily even so much what the legislation provides. It's the extraordinary, I think, inclination to acquire power and exercise it in the federal bureaucracy, which for all practical purposes right now is virtually unchecked. Every now and then, the courts intervene to make minor modifications, but the real problem is not, as I say, the legislation or the regulations, but the bureaucracy itself.
Well, let's talk about the circumstances. Obviously, 9/11 was an extremely jarring event because the U.S., this doesn't happen in the U.S. We're protected by oceans. We rain down terror on other countries. This doesn't happen to us. So it was extremely disorienting. And so I think people were inclined to say, under these circumstances, we have to consider it acceptable for the government to have these sorts of powers. And I want to share a sentence that you quote from Richard Posner, who's a very brilliant judge, although I have some problems with him, but here's one of them. He says, rooting out an invisible enemy in our midst might be fatally inhibited if we felt constrained to strict observance of civil liberties designed in and for eras in which the only serious internal threat, apart from spies, came from common criminals. Now, I want to address that because that is the average person's view, that I understand that in normal times, civil liberties are very important, and of course, I wouldn't want my home raided or my privacy violated. But for heaven's sake, if we have an enemy that has made clear its intent to destroy us, and let's stipulate for the sake of argument that that's correct, how do you intend to protect me against it, Mr. Civil Libertarian?
Well, it's a great question, but the real problem is at one point, does the government simply have too much power? I mean, after all, we have a Fourth Amendment that's supposed to protect us against unreasonable searches and seizures. And where we've reached the point where the bureaucracy and the intelligence services of the federal government can spy on a presidential candidate, you have to wonder whether we've gone too far. It's quite true. And Posner's book, I think you may remember, had this in its title. He pointed out that the Constitution was not a suicide pact, but there comes a point at which fear for security nullifies your rights. And I think in many ways, we've passed that point.
I think some of the ways that people have responded, people on our side of things have responded when asked questions like this, is to say, let's look at the TSA, or let's look at some of the changes that have been made in either surveillance or security since then. They haven't done any good. Sometimes our side will make a utilitarian argument. They haven't done any good. The TSA is not stopping terrorists. And we've all, I got a steak knife through the TSA. I didn't mean to, but I was coming from my work when I used to be a professor, and I had brought some leftover steak with me for lunch, and then I was flying to a conference. And the steak knife was still in the briefcase. I sailed right through. No problem. So we do have that they're just not that effective. And I think that that can be a powerful argument. But then the answer would come, well, then I guess we just need more of it.
Yeah. Again, it's a balancing act, I guess, much as I hate to use that term. But right now, I think the problem is on the liberty side and not the security side. As I tried to indicate in my piece, and granted, this is a little bit speculative, but the conditions in the Arab world and on the Arab street are very different from what they were in September of 2001. There's much less unity in the Arab community, and I think their internal problems are probably greater at this point than their desire to wreak havoc on the American homeland. The internecine struggles between the Shiites and the Sunnis are much greater than they were. And the Arab community itself is now split on making alliances with Israel. Back in 2001, the entire community was dead set in favor of the Palestinians. Now Iran has entered the equation, and it's a much more complex world. But I think with regard to international terror threats, it may actually be less dangerous than it was.
Incidentally, on Posner, just one quick thing, just because I've written a book on the financial crisis of 2008, he wrote a book called A Failure of Capitalism.
Right.
And when somebody said, okay, well, you know, maybe there's an argument to be made for that. But on the other hand, there are a lot of observers who have said the Federal Reserve System created some instability with its money creation. What do you think about that? And his answer was that the Federal Reserve System was part of capitalism, even though it's a monopoly institution created by an act of Congress. You know, so that he was just begging the whole question. So I know that in principle, he's a brilliant guy. But when push comes to shove, he is just kicking me in the teeth time and again. So anyway, I don't want to dwell on that. Let's talk instead about, you mentioned Edward Snowden in your article. I want to know, what exactly is it that he disclosed to us that we did not know already about the extent of the surveillance by the U.S. regime?
Yeah, to the best extent that I can remember, I think he was disclosing two things. One is the cooperation among the various intelligence agencies, which the Patriot Act now permits. There's a mix now of domestic and foreign surveillance that didn't exist before then. And I forget the other precise things that he was involved in, but I think he just made it clear that the possibility of abuse was greater than we had thought.
Well, in fact, now that I'm looking right at it, Edward Snowden, other whistleblowers, we now know that, and then this is a quotation from the ACLU, an unknown number of purely domestic communications are monitored. The rules that supposedly protect Americans' privacy are weak and riddled with exceptions, and that virtually every email that goes into or out of the United States is scanned for suspicious keywords. And then you say in a previous paragraph, we have another quotation from the ACLU, that it gave in the wake of the Patriot Act. So then we have the various FISA amendments of 2008. And then this is what we read, that this gave the National Security Administration almost unchecked power to monitor Americans' international phone calls, text messages, and emails under the guise of targeting foreigners abroad. It's interesting, by the way, that we're quoting the American Civil Liberties Union, because I've been having some fun with them on Twitter lately, because they recently complained about and are going to be filing suit against, apparently, the state of South Carolina for banning mask mandates. They want to be able to allow mask mandates, and that's a civil liberty, apparently. So I had a little fun with them. I said, I'm afraid somebody must have accidentally deleted your series of tweets warning about the civil liberties aspects of the vaccine passport systems coming up in our cities. Somebody must have accidentally deleted all your tweets about that, because I can't find a single word about that anywhere in your feed. Of course, we all know they haven't said a word about it because they all support it.
Yeah, you have to wonder if it's our father's ACLU or not.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I would even take the ACLU of, 15 years ago when they were saying stuff like this.
Right. But, I mean, we keep coming back to the basic problem, and that's, can you trust the bureaucracy? And I think the answer is you can never trust any bureaucracy. And we need to be a little more sensitive to that than we have been.
Now, you, in this article, you draw, after a discussion of what's going on in 20 years ago and in the ensuing years with surveillance, then you're drawing parallels. And I thought it was quite apt for you to say that the kinds of silliness and indignities that Americans have been subjected to at airports and that we've more or less gone along with, these sorts of things created a kind of passivity that led to, or at least in some way contributed to, the passivity with which I would say most Americans have received the mask mandates and the stand 6 feet apart and the don't do this and don't do that and 10 people at your father's funeral and all that. It's all of a piece. And secondly, I think that another important parallel for today is it was very easy for some people in the official conservative movement to turn a blind eye to these dangers when they thought they were going to be directed at evil towel heads who wished us ill. But now when suddenly they're running out of those people to target, all of a sudden it is you, Mr. Conservative, who is being targeted as a potential domestic terror threat. Well, how about that? That's the way that goes.
Well, that's exactly right. Just like the ACLU, Thomas Jefferson didn't get everything right, but he did get right the idea that the best government is that closest to the people. And we need to reinvigorate that notion in contemporary America. We academics tend to call it federalism, but the idea is to let some more power flow back to the states and the localities. Among some quarters, there's a lot of fear of that, but I think it's a lot better than a remote federal government and an even more remote federal bureaucracy.
How long did you teach at Northwestern's law school?
I taught at Northwestern for 42 years and 3 years at other places before that. So 45 years teaching law school in all.
Okay. And I'm sure you had contact with a great many colleagues in law. And it seems to an outside observer like me that the law schools are no better than, frankly, the divinity schools, that overwhelmingly somebody like a Stephen Presser is in the minority, that when the Federalist Society comes along, even just to have debates, to say, listen, we'll engage with your ideas, but we want to have an open debate, they're demonized and viewed as extremists. Do you have hope for the law schools? What's your feeling after all those years of being in one?
Well, to answer the last question first, yes, I still have hope, but I also have despair when I think about it. And I'm not at all miserable being out of the classroom. It's not a very receptive place to somebody with conservative ideas these days. On the other hand, the hope comes from things like the Federalist Society. And I think you and I probably talked about this last time. It's the most vibrant group of legal academics and lawyers and law professors and judges that's out there. It's got thousands of members, and it really is committed both to federalism and to separation of powers. The idea that courts shouldn't legislate, and that indeed only legislatures ought to be able to do that. And those are the two most important things anybody needs to think about. There are always rhythms in these ideas. And you'll probably remember, Tom, that in 1988, we all thought socialism was inevitable. And then the Berlin Wall fell and things changed. I think we can still hope. I think Donald Trump's election was a sign that there is fear of the federal government and that there's a need for fundamental change, and in particular, a need to rein in the bureaucracy. So I still have some hope, but my goodness, I've never seen crazier ideas coming out of the academy. And you alluded to the very interesting divinity school problem that these days a lot of divinity school professors, and as we saw at Harvard the other day, a lot of chaplains are atheists. And unfortunately, there are too many people in the law schools who really don't believe in the law anymore. They believe that the law is whatever a judge says it is on a given day in a given place. And that's a fundamental difficulty that needs work.
It reminds me, frankly, and maybe this will seem like hyperbole, but in the early years of the Bolsheviks, I recall it might have even been Lenin saying that what we need from judges is not that they've, you know, memorized old law books, but that they rule with a revolutionary consciousness. That's what matters. And, you know, you can trot out precedents if you want to have some window dressing for your decision, but let's make no mistake. You knew what outcome you wanted before you found those precedents. And frankly, that doesn't sound all that different, you know, right, from what we have these days. And likewise, your article says that, talks about the just how absolutely unresponsive the bureaucracy is, and we get these 2,700-page bills that we all know nobody's reading, and it seems like impossible to dislodge them. Even you get a populist president who gets elected, and he gets eaten alive by them.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, until the Republican Party starts doing something about that kind of thing, we're going to continue to be in trouble. I do, as I say, have some hope, but it's interesting what you just said. There's a wonderful and delightful fellow. His name is Mark Tushnet. I suspect you've heard of him. He teaches at Harvard now. He's a good friend and a wonderful man. But about 30 years ago, he said that if he were a judge, he would render decisions that, just as you suggested, cited a bunch of precedents and were in the line of whatever grand theory was popular at the time, but his aim would simply be to establish socialism in the country. And Mark wasn't alone at that time. And I'm afraid that there's still a very Marxist foundation for a lot of the things that are going on in the academy in general and in law schools as well. It isn't quite completely captured yet, but if it hasn't been captured by Marxism, it has been captured by total judicial discretion.
All right, I'm going to ask you something that if you weren't with Chronicles Magazine, I wouldn't even bring up. But if I can't ask this question of somebody with Chronicles Magazine, whom can I ask? And that is, how do you feel about the idea of secession?
Well, I mean, I'm not opposed to it. There's a book written by a man named Frank Buckley.
Oh, I had him on to talk about it, American Secession, yes.
And he's also a friend. And I mean, the trend around the world is towards decentralization. And it might be that this country could conceivably be better off if we split into two or three different nations. I think it's wrong completely to reject the idea. I'd rather fix the government we've got now, but it's not clear that that's possible.
Yeah, that seems to be the issue, is that everybody who tries gets swallowed up, or not to mention the media is so relentlessly hostile to anyone who has an independent thought that it's, to me, it's a miracle that it's not 80 or 90% of Americans who support socialism and a variety of other things. I'm surprised we've lasted this long with a more or less, you know, free enterprise-ish system. I'm surprised. I don't see where that's being supported, not in the educational system, not in the media, not the political classes. I'm surprised we made it this far, frankly.
Well, you remember, Tom, what's said, and that's that God protects children, fools, in the United States of
America. States of America. That's right. That's right.
That's what we have to rely on in the end.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, BitTrust IRA. A lot of people have been putting crypto into their IRAs. And if you're thinking of doing the same thing, adding Bitcoin to your retirement account, the best way is through BitTrust IRA. The crypto world can be confusing. It's hard to know where to get started. These guys will help you. BitTrust IRA stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. And by the way, when they say nuclear bunkers, that isn't just hyperbole where they're saying it's really, really secure. We're actually talking about decommissioned nuclear bunkers. They have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. So how do you get started? Go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners. That's a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods. bittrustira.com/woods. What do you see? I'm very bad at predicting things. Not that my predictions go wrong. It's that I'm too much of a coward to make them in the first place. I like being a historian because then I'm never wrong. All those things did happen. I can show it to you.
Right.
The future is much trickier. So what about the near future? What do you think next year we have the off-year elections? Now, you would think that the Democrats, you know, might struggle a little bit. I mean, Biden's numbers aren't that great and he hasn't really looked all that good recently. But I don't know. There are a lot of factors that might wind up making him get through it okay. The thing is, I thought by now there would be a massive, massive response to the COVID restrictions and people saying enough is enough. This is ridiculous. We have to live with it and live our lives. And even plenty of grandmas and grandpas say, I don't want my grandchildren's lives ruined. I want them to live. And I've been extremely disappointed that there hasn't been more of that. I thought that would be a definite winner for the Republicans in 2022. Of course, I don't know that there are some Republicans who don't even want to run on it because they're like the Republican governors. Many of them have been terrible. Can you put on your forecasting hat and tell me what you see coming in the next year or so?
Well, we know the history, as you suggest. In off-year elections that follow presidential elections, the trend has been for the party out of the White House to gain plenty of seats. Surely, we should be able to maintain the Senate, add a senator or two, and probably take the House. If we don't, I think what it means is our fears about elections being rigged need to be pursued. I don't see how the Democrats can maintain their majorities. But unfortunately, I've been wrong on virtually every political prediction I've ever made, except for Kamala Harris being the Democrats' vice presidential candidate this time.
Oh, that's interesting. You predicted that. I thought she was so unlikable and her numbers were so bad that she brought nothing of value. I mean, other than the obvious, I suppose.
Yeah, well, that's it. It's the intersectionality.
Yeah.
That's what the ticket needed. And I think, I mean, if I had to guess, I'd also guess that they didn't perceive her as much of a threat. But we'll see.
What kind of advice do you have for somebody who wants to go into law? Are there branches of law that are saner and sounder in terms of both the education in them and the practice of them than others?
Well, yeah. Corporations, administrative law indeed, is a place where there's a lot of good work that remains to be done. Securities law is vibrant and interesting. Antitrust law is continuing to be fascinating. And sometimes antitrust law runs against what you would expect. So that they're basically business law areas now look the most interesting to me. And I was a teacher of business associations and corporations for, I think, 35 years. And I think that's a fascinating and wonderful area. And much as I have problems with lots of things in the law schools, the discipline of law is still terrific. And one thing that those thinking about law school need to do is to be deeply steeped in the history of law. And my guess is the more they are, the less chance there is in the future we'll make the kind of mistakes we've been making lately. And of course, I have some books, two of which are written by me, that I could recommend in that regard.
Well, you may as well.
One is called Law Professors, Three Centuries of Shaping American Law, which studies what's gone wrong and the few things that are right about the legal academy. And the other is a book from 1994, as valid then as it is now, called Recapturing the Constitution, in which I explore how the Supreme Court has gone badly off the track.
All right, I'll link to both of those on the show notes page. And that's tomwoods.com/1964. Let me ask you one more thing. When I was in high school, I actually read Judge Bork's book, The Tempting of America. That was 1987. What do you think of that book, first of all?
I have two thoughts on that book. One is his attack on unbridled judicial discretion is entirely correct. And it's a great book to read if you want to see where the courts have gone wrong. The only trouble I had with that book is that he's not much of a fan of natural law. And there have certainly been abuses by courts who've created law out of whole cloth and called it natural law. But there is a tradition in America that's a very valuable one. And that is that our law is undergirded with religion. And as the Federalist framers used to say, there can be no order without law, no law without morality, and no morality without religion. And we shouldn't forget that. And I think to an extent, Judge Bork did.
Okay. Is that the same kind of criticism you would have of Judge Scalia?
Yes, although much less, because Scalia, I think, pays a lot more attention to tradition than Bork did. And I think Scalia's grounding in our Judeo-Christian moral values is deeper than Bork's. And if you had to pick one Supreme Court justice in the 20th century who got it right most of the time, it's Scalia.
Yes.
I mean, I should say the other is Clarence Thomas.
Yes. I love him. Yeah, absolutely love him. Now, the reason I bring this up is that that book, again, I was a high school student, but I was a nerd, obviously, because I just thought, well, this is a controversial person. I want to hear his side of the story. And so I felt like it was only fair of me to read. I was 15 years old? But I felt like I should do it. And that book totally shaped the way I looked at all these issues thereafter. I mean, I've read other books, but that one gave me the framework for understanding. And I ask about it because it really was, I thought, a brilliant exposition of the problems that we faced. And it was not particularly difficult to read. I wouldn't say I agreed with, I still don't think he's right about absolutely everything, but it's absolutely well worth reading. And to think that a person with a mind like his, like whatever criticisms you may have of him, he had a tremendous legal mind. And the things they put him through, like they went to try to see what movies he'd been renting so that maybe if he had anything salacious was to be found. And it turns out he was renting like Fred Astaire movies. Like they couldn't find anything on this guy except that they were able to portray him as an extremist, even though in his, I think one of the things they said about him, now I'm getting off on a tangent, I need to let you go, but I think one of the things they said about him was that he wouldn't have favored the Brown versus Board decision. And in the book, he shows how with his reasoning, you could get to the Brown versus Board decision. As I recall, that may have been it, that he was so extreme, so-called, as a strict constructionist, that he couldn't get us to some of the outcomes that we all know we want.
Well, there is that. But I should say that I agree with you about the book. It's a great read. And you may remember a passage in the book where, following Ted Kennedy's disgraceful Robert Bork's America speech, where he says Judge Bork would shut down desegregated lunch counters and drive women to back alley abortions and lots of other outrageous and untrue things. Bork apparently had a conversation with Kennedy, and he said to him, "You know, Senator, none of those things are true." And Kennedy reportedly, he says in the book, said back to him, "Of course I know that. This is just politics." And the whole point is, law is not politics. And it's tragic that it's become that. And that people like Senator Kennedy don't seem to see there's a problem there.
I guess this is where I wanted to ultimately wind up. That book was written 34 years ago. And now you have mentioned a book of your own. Is there any other book written more recently in this kind of tradition that you would recommend somebody read to get a good handle on what the proper approach to constitutional law ought to be?
Well, the law professor's book of mine is 2017, and it's still perfectly timely. There's also a book on the Constitution by Michael Paulson and his son, whose name escapes me right now, but it's a short book, and it's a very, very good treatment by a solid traditionalist conservative.
All right, I'm jotting all these down, and for people who can't keep track of all this, I'll put every book we mentioned up at tomwoods.com/1964. Well, we drifted a bit from the surveillance stuff, but just because I can talk to you about almost anything, and I wanted to ask you these things. I haven't spoken to a legal person in a really long time, and now I've got some good reading ahead of me. So thank you, first of all, for this article. I'm going to urge people to consider subscribing to Chronicles magazine. Yes, the print edition. I want you to get a print magazine, because this is the magazine that back in 1994 published my first article ever. And I have loved it ever since. It is a source of learned, extremely intelligent, right of center writing. It's not Sean Hannity on paper. It's really, really good, thought-provoking, learned stuff by some of the best people we have, which is why no one's ever heard of it, because that's the way things work in this world. But you, dear listener, are going to help change that by subscribing to Chronicles Magazine. I'll put the link, chroniclesmagazine.org, also on the show notes page. You won't regret it. You'll just love it. And maybe sometimes it'll infuriate you, but sometimes it's fun to be infuriated. It gets your creative juices flowing. So anyway, thank you for the article that appeared in that magazine and for your time today.
Always a treat to talk with you, Tom.
Okay, folks, a couple things to tell you before we wrap up for today. First thing has to do with a listener website. Now, of course, I'm sure you're aware that the subject of abortion is very controversial in libertarian circles. And the website I want to tell you about today is for what's being called the pro-life liberty movement. And what it's seeking to do is to insert a pro-life ethic into the liberty movement and a liberty ethic into the pro-life movement. And they intend to do that through various means, including a political action committee, but not limited to that. So the site is libertyprolife.org. It's filled with resources and articles you'll want to check out. So libertyprolife.org is the website. I'm linking to it at tomwoods.com/1964. You'll find news items and backgrounders there that, if you consider yourself pro-life, you will certainly find helpful. So libertyprolife.org is the website. Remember, if you're thinking of starting a website, I'll promote it for you. You got to just use my link to get your hosting, and I'll promote it here on the show. And I've got other free benefits that come with that that are really going to give you a big advantage out of the gate. So check out the details regarding how to get those and what my free goodies are at tomwoods.com/publicity. Second thing I want to tell you about tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm having Ben Settle back on the show. It's been a while since I've had him on. He is one of the handful of people I've ever given a testimonial to. This is a guy who has without a doubt changed my life. Brilliant guy, cantankerous and funny, but brilliant and very knowledgeable. And I just want to talk to him as an expert marketer, which is what he is, about what he thinks about the current situation. And you know, what do you do when you're living in a world where you can be deplatformed at a moment's notice, where your employer can require you to not just take a vaccine, but who knows what could be coming down the road? What sorts of things should we do? What sort of strategy should we be pursuing in a world like that? So we're going to have a great and wide-ranging conversation. And it's always fun talking to Ben Settle. I've not had anyone ever say, boy, that was a boring conversation you had with Ben Settle. That's never happened. Never happened. If he goes to renew a magazine subscription, the ensuing conversation is interesting with Ben Settle. So make sure you tune in. Do not miss episode 1965, and I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.